He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Mai whakaronga mai ki te Aotai Whanua. Welcome to Country Life. I'm Sally Round.
And I'm Duncan Smith. G'day. Today, what to do about stained fleeces? Wool needs all the help it can get, and one man believes he has the answer.
We're at a bumper Fijoa harvest in Hawke's Bay.
And later on, Cosmo boats out to a salmon farm near the heads of Akaroa Harbour.
But first to our look at the conditions on the land this week. Northland has had chilly temperatures in recent days, but not the frosts that have been hitting many other North Island spots this week. The kumara harvest is all over, and there are plenty of them in storage. The grower we caught up with says the quality is good, so they'll be nice eating. He was looking forward to cooler months when the sales generally pick up. But a heads up, he said, red kumara will be excellent supermarket buying next week. Pukekohe received a little rain on Tuesday and a frost Thursday morning, but otherwise it's been fine and calm, and the district remains abnormally dry. In the past 4.5 months, approximately half the normal rain has arrived, leaving a shortfall of at least 200 millimetres. Late crop potatoes were damaged weeks ago by blight, and the tops have prematurely collapsed. Yields are down and tuber sizes are much smaller. All early onion crops have been sown, but it's so dry they needed irrigation for the seed to germinate.
Waikato had between 2 and 15 millimetres of rain on Monday, which is not enough to do anything much. Western Hill sheep and beef farms are dry and dusty, as are dairy farms. And for dairy farmers moving properties at the end of the month, they've edged yet another week closer to that event without any hope of pasture growth picking up. Many will be struggling to meet contractually required pasture cover levels, so all parties are being urged to talk to each other to work out manageable solutions. It's been marvellous kiwifruit harvesting weather in Bay of Plenty. The last of the gold crops now pretty well picked, and everyone can get into the main green harvest. Despite the labour shortages, the fruit's getting packed on time. But growers and packhouses are noticing more damaged fruit from harvesting. The first consignment of kiwifruit for the North American market is unloading now. It's shared its journey to the United States with New Zealand apples.
King Country is dry and needs rain. Pastures are short, and now there have been a couple of cracking frosts. Growth will slow up even more. Cattle are still hard to get off farms because of a lack of works killing space. But just this week, lambs have started to move again, which is a relief. Taranaki also had some good frost this week with sunny days. Most dairy herds are now dried off and feed levels on farms are okay. Production for the year is about 6% behind last season. There's a dusting of snow on Mount Taranaki. It's late arriving.
It feels like winter in the Gisborne district now, but grass is still growing. Rain is continuing to arrive on a regular basis, which is keeping creeks flowing quite high. Farmers will welcome the cooler temperatures because lambs grow better when it's not so hot. They've been able to send lambs to the works in a timely fashion, although there are still road access issues for some, both on farm and on local highways. Hawke's Bay is continuing to have its best autumn run in years. Grass growth has been so good, farmers aren't having to use the amount of nitrogen fertiliser that they normally would, and they'll be able to start feeding winter crops later than usual.
It's been spectacular weather in Wairarapa, sunshiny days. A little rain fell earlier in the week, which freshened things up quickly, but frosts by the week's end will put paid to too much more growth. Dairy production hasn't been startling for the season as a whole, but May milk volumes have been much better than last May. Dairy farmers are milking their empty cows on to the end of the season because they can't get them into the meatworks. Farmers are generally buoyant. Horowhenua had very welcome rain this week, between 20 and 40 millimetres depending where you were. Just wonderful. There have been a couple of good frosts, but with warmer, moist weather predicted again, there's hope growth will come in this brief window before the real winter hits. Dairy farmers are still milking on.
Gold kiwifruit pickings coming to an end in the Nelson Motueka region. Dry weather this week has helped harvesting a lot. Overall, fruit size is excellent, and compared to last year, when a Boxing Day hailstorm devastated the crop, yields are well up. Pickers are moving over to the Hayward variety, where there's still about 1 million trays to come off. apple harvesting's finished, and our contact says growers worked really well together to ensure everyone had staff to pick and pack the fruit. Marlborough's had 30 millimetres of the wet stuff on Monday, and it was needed, according to a farmer near Blenheim. The farm has 1,500 kilograms of dry matter per hectare of grass cover, so feed levels are looking pretty good for winter. Out in the paddock, rams have finished their work with the ewes and pre-lamb shearings just around the corner. While in the province's vineyards, pruning's getting underway.
And much needed rain fell this week over Canterbury. Things were on the dry side and some farmers were using small amounts of irrigation. Normally, irrigation systems are switched off by now. Dairy cows, beef cattle and sheep are just starting on winter feed crops as pasture growth slows up. The last wheat crops are being planted and annual winter farm maintenance is in full swing. A Barrytown farmer on the west coast says a localised rainstorm on Sunday caused slips from there south to Greymouth. A digger's been clearing the road, some paddocks are covered in logs, silt and rocks, and he says a large shed was wiped out on a neighbouring farm, just missing the house. Apart from that, the weather's been lovely, he says. Dairy farmers are spreading lime and supplementary feeding cows. Herds are slowly being dried off. Some surplus to requirement cows are still on farm as delays at the freezing works continue.
In South Otago, a sheep farmer near Balclutha says with only 4 millimetres of rain this month, the ground is getting dry. Grass covers are low going into winter too, so he's having a close look at the feed budget to ensure there's enough supplementary feed to carry through to spring. It comes down to the last kilo, he says. Costs are going through the roof, with grain nearly double the price of what it was a year ago. He says the last of the works lambs are finally gone, and a late application of urea's been applied to paddocks to boost winter growth. Grass growth's doing okay in Southland after some good rain in April. A farmer in Edendale says it's the best early May he's seen in 10 years, but overall it's been the worst season ever for grass growth, down 4 tonne per hectare of grass. Milk production's down a tad on last year, but it's not too bad all things considered. He says drying off will start in 10 days with the early calvers. Farmers have been visiting wintering blocks to measure the feed crops. This is to ensure they are paying for what they get. At $40 a week per cow for 10 weeks, it's an expensive stay. The farmer we talked to says wintering his cows off farm costs him hundreds of thousands of dollars.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
Our guest this week is keen to help get wool out of the doldrums. He told Sally he's heard some horror stories about the fibre being rejected when it gets to market. It's around about now that sheep are going through the pregnancy scanner, and the mark on their fleece, which signifies the number of lambs they're carrying, can cause some issues.
Well, it's a busy stockyard today here at Stortford Lodge in Hastings, and I'm here with Richard Kettle. Richard, tell me about your company.
My company's called AHD Limited, which is Animal Health Direct Limited. And we've been going 20 years and based in Hawke's Bay. And we're sort of more focused on the production animal side of the industry, which is the sheep, cattle and dairy market. We developed the product called Fadeaway a couple of years ago. And it was developed with the idea of trying to solve this problem of stained wool, which was becoming a big issue. And basically it was just that the stained wool would not wash clean. And so it devalued the product and caused a lot of headaches for exporters if it turned up in overseas markets and the whole consignment would get rejected.
Now, why do sheep need to be marked?
Okay, so it's basically the biggest time is the scanning, which is coming up now, where they're scanning the ewes for pregnancy, so identifying ewes with triplets, twins or singles or dry ewes, so that the farmer can, one, get rid of the dry ewes early and look after the in-lamb ewes, and then when it comes to set stocking for lambing, they can identify the sheep 3 months, 4 months out from now. Prior to scanning coming along, they would go through the farmers and basically just feel for the udders on the ewe, and if the milk was starting to show up there, they'd mark the head of the sheep with the rattle, so that wasn't going on the wool really, or very little was. And with scanning coming along and pushing numbers through quickly, some of the scanners are automated, and they'll just push a button and it'll spray a colour on the back, push another bundle, spray another colour, you know, for, if she's got triplets.
What was happening in wool sheds before?
Yeah, so with the value of the wool being so low and the cost of shearing going up, unfortunately farmers are sort of turning, not all farmers, but a lot of them just saying, chucking it all in the bale and sending it off. And it got to a stage where they were told by their wool buying companies, anything with marks or anything on it, take out and dump it on the farm, or, you know, but don't send it to us. We don't want it. It's got no value. They can't wash it, and no one wants to buy it. But unfortunately, a bit of it was sneaking through into the main fleece as well. We're still highly...
Why was it sneaking through?
I guess our farmers being a little bit naughty with don't worry about it.
Was it a cost issue?
Yeah, they could probably cut two rouses down out of the shearing gang. It's less wages they were paying to get the sheep shorn. But I've got to stress, even now with fade away, and we know it washes out, it's still the right thing to do to take any coloured wool out. But the beauty of it is, if it's coloured wool marked by fade away, they can get that washed and get some value for it. And it's far better than throwing it down a hole.
What's the secret ingredient?
I'd love to share that with you, but I won't. But there is a secret sauce, and it's a natural product. And what it tends, its behaviour of the product is, it will sit on top of the wool, and it dries instantly on top of the wool, rather than going down into it and spreading, especially if it's wet, spreading through the fleece. It just won't do that. One of the things we had to be sure of was fading away or washing out's great, but it still had to stay there in the rain and bits and pieces and last a distance so the farmer could still identify it. We did our own sort of agricultural testing initially, and then got more serious about it when we knew we were onto something. And we did an independent trial with Woolworks over in Napier, and they went through their plant and came out 100% clean, and which they followed up with an endorsement of the product. And then more recently we gained the AWTA, the Australian Wool Testing Authority certificate, which is basically an Australasian standard that the wool industry looks for. That means the product does what it says it will do.
What are some of the stories you've heard about fleece being rejected when it gets to the market?
Yeah, there's some pretty horrific horror stories here, really, of especially in China. They're pretty particular, and they buy a lot of our carpet wool, the coarse wool for carpet. And if they open a container up and open the bale up and there's some stained wool in there, it's the door's shut. And the message is back to the New Zealand seller, broker, pick it up. Take the whole lot back. So, and then these, and I've been into the plants and seen it, where there's this wool everywhere, and they've got employed people to go through it and pull out the stained wool, repress it, and then dry again. It's a big problem. It does cost the industry millions of dollars, and that's not an exaggeration. That's coming from the industry itself. The whole wool industry is doing everything it can to try and lift the value of wool. And that was one of the key reasons for us coming up with Fade Away, was to help that coarse wool, mainly industry, get a lift in the price to the farmer.
Richard Kettle.
On the slopes of Hawke's Bay's Tamata Peak, many hands have been busy harvesting large, plump feijoas. The grower, Heather Smith, says it's been a fantastic season for the fruit, which she fell in love with when she arrived from the United States nearly 27 years ago. A couple of weeks ago, on a warm autumn day, I hitched a ride with Heather up to one of her two orchards and found the pickers on their break, enjoying the view in the shade of a shelter belt.
What a beautiful spot. We've got views out over the Tukituki Valley with Tamata Peak in the background.
We hire a lot of moms with kids because the hours start at 9 and you can leave anytime after 1. So we've got a beautiful crew of women. The fruit is so thick on the ground. And then if someone tests positive for COVID, then they can't show up for 7 days. So it's really sporadic. So we've had to almost overhire. Like today we've got 14 people out there, and you know, normally we'd have 6. So yeah, it's a different year.
I've got a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old, and the Heather and the team here are really fantastic with allowing me to work around the hours that they're in care and pickups and drop-offs and things like that. So it's really accommodating. It's brilliant. It's a great place to work.
This is my 3rd year on harvest, and every year the majority of the team seems to be mothers with children. So the 9 o'clock start is really it's a good time. for that. And then some people leave at 2, and if you can get extra care, you can stay all day. Yeah, that's very flexible.
Feed joas for morning tea?
And we generally eat them as we come back down the road. Yeah.
Do you ever get sick of them?
No.
Had you heard about feed joas before?
No, actually. I'm English, and trying to explain it to my family, it was really interesting. It was like, it's a sort of like an apple slash a passion fruit or something in between. So hard to describe them.
I love feed joas. They're my favourite. And I really struggle to not eat them all.
Yeah. How do you harvest feed joas?
Well, we go up to the tree, give it a little tiny shake, like this. And then the beautiful fruit falls down on our organic ground, and we pick them up, put them in buckets. And in bins or crates, the first we tend to touch pick. So you go up, you can see the color change on a fruit. It gets a little bit lighter, and you know it's ready to drop off into your hand.
So it's all done on the color and the size, I guess?
No, they vary in size, huge, huge variation in size. It's just when they're ready to come off. So mostly the color and if they let go. So there are two orchards on the farm. There's one big one. It's got 1,300 plus trees, and it's a mixed. It's a Triumph seedling cross, which is really an experiment because there's no named varieties in there. And the other smaller orchard is about 6 named varieties. So, my favorite being Mammoth and Golden Goose and White Goose.
Have you done your own experimentation?
Well, I know the trees that produce certain sizes every year and that are really good every year or really late every year, but I've never taken I haven't had the time to say, oh, this is the next best variety. You know, that's not my...
So you're very hands-on.
Yeah, incredibly hands-on. Probably too hands-on. Yeah, I'm very hands-on.
So do you do all the pruning and mulching?
I do, yep. I have. We're getting better systems where now I've got this amazing mower where the grass just gets thrown up against the tree and around the tree, as you can see. But when the trees were starting out, we would put lots of wood chips on them, lots of like old straw, because we used to grow wheat and barley here. So we really nurtured them when they were little. So they're a little less care now. But every other year we'll do a big prune in either orchard.
So pretty easy care.
They're easy care. And here in Hawke's Bay, we haven't had the issues that they've had up north, which has been quite sad. There's an anthracnose fungus and the guava moth, of course. We had bronze beetle, but I just made a spray up of garlic and chili peppers and a little bit of soap and made a big spray, and we sprayed the orchard, and that got rid of the bronze beetle. Oh, and we also planted maize in the middle of the rows, so disturbing their habitat where they, not nest, but hibernate and grow. We just tilled the soil, planted maize. It also acted as a windbreak when they were little, and that took care of it. When I moved to New Zealand, I tried a feed joa and thought, wow, this is amazing. It's unknown in America. Why is it, you know, it's a mystery. So I decided to plant 2,000 trees.
Have you got a background in horticulture?
Not necessarily. I have a background. I have a Bachelor of Science in Biology. So I've always been into things green, so to speak.
So what a huge step to come from the States, taste a feed joa, and then decide to set up an orchard.
Yes, and a processing orchard, because as I looked into feed joas, more and more it came back that, oh, they're hard to ship fresh, you know, because they're so soft. And they have to fall off the tree or be touch picked. They have to be ready to come off for them to continue ripening, unlike other fruit. So in order to get any benefit out of them, really, they need to be softer. So shipping fresh was hard. So I thought, well, what can we do with these? Everybody's sort of doing juice. But freeze-drying started coming in, so I played around with that and came up with these freeze-dried wedges. Actually, my first thing was frozen, whole peeled frozen. So I got a lovely small family-owned company, a couple of them in Hastings, to experiment with me. So we made 1 kg bags of whole peeled organic feijoas. And I took it to this lovely gentleman who's big in the organic world here in Hawke's Bay. And I said, would you be interested in purchasing these whole peeled frozen? And I had an experimental bag of the freeze-dried wedges. And so he said, oh, yeah, we'll definitely be interested in the frozen. But he had a taste of the wedges. And I swear, tears just about came to his eyes. He's like, you have to do this. So I did. And then since then, we've done freeze-dried powder. We've got a beautiful little facial toner spray. And one of the big attributes of feijoa is that it's highly antifungal and antibacterial. It's loaded with vitamin C. It's like 4 times more than kiwi, especially in our freeze-dried powder, and potassium. So, and there's a lot of, we're getting a little bit of research done now, and it's amazing the amount of molecules in there that are so good for you.
Are you looking at developing new products?
I'm looking at, in a perfect world, someone, a high network individual, would set up a factory in Whakatu or Hastings and dedicate it to freeze-drying feijoas, shapes and powders, dehydrating feijoas. You're making puree, the whole peel frozen, and, you know, have it be a focal point for feijoas, but obviously use the machinery for off-season fruit as well, as you have to do. Because there's nothing focused on the feijoa. You have to go to all these other places that are so busy, and I'm not a big enough company to hold a lot of sway. They've been very kind to me to process my stuff.
How much fruit do you produce?
Oh, well, this year I think it'll be a record breaker because of all this beautiful rain. I'm guessing 80 ton this year. Our highest before this has been 52.
And how much of that goes into the processed products and how much into fresh?
Oh, some years it's 100% into the processed. This year, because the fruit's so good, we've got a few more organic markets that we're selling to as market grade.
And is it a local market or is it an export market as well?
Fresh fruit is all domestic. Other people are exporting fresh fruit. I let them do that. That's their deal. But with the products, we have sold to Singapore, Hong Kong. We've got a woman from Korea who's interested. We sell online all over the place, Norway, you know, America, Germany.
So when you came back in the late 90s and you were so taken by the feijoa, what were your thoughts? Did you think, why isn't anyone doing more with this fruit?
Absolutely. Yep. Yep. Why? And so that's why, you know, the kitchen table experiments that you do, jelly, puree, the whole peel frozen, wedges, you know, how do you figure out to mechanically wedge a feijoa? It's really hard. So yeah, all those things. And if there was technology and a little money behind it, because I've done this company on a shoestring, I think it would be the next kiwi and surpassing. Because kiwi is great fresh, whereas the integrity of the feijoa just stays. And the longevity of that flavor is powerful. So come on into the feijoa headquarters, as I like to call it.
It's a corrugated iron shed. Looks like stables originally,
maybe? It used to be the farm's workshop. There's even a carpet.
Yes, I can see a whole big hole down there.
So this is our semi-warehouse. We've got freeze-dried feijoa powder, 1 kg or 5 kg packs for food industry, and our freeze-dried wedges, which come in these 25-gram packs. Would you like to try one?
Yeah, I'd love to. Thank you. So this is just like a wedge, and it's been freeze-dried.
Yeah.
And looks crunchy.
Skin on.
Skin on.
Have a bite.
Mmm. Wow. Yeah, now the feijoa is coming through.
Mmm.
Once you moisten it up a bit.
Mmm. Oh, I get the feijoa right away.
Oh, do you?
Mm-hmm. Mmm. Yeah, and then we've got our little essence.
They've got a little bit of a tang as well.
Yeah,
because
the skin's
they?
On. But we left the skin on two reasons. One, it would be highly uneconomical to peel them. And you'd be taking away all that vitamin C and potassium. And okay, so this is our essence. It's just the skin and water with a certain process. This was me experimenting in the kitchen. So you ready?
Yeah.
Okay, close your eyes.
And this fragrance, it's beautiful.
If you're feeling a bit like
reviving.
You need a cup of coffee, just have a spritz of that.
Mm.
And then we've got jelly. And this is pretty much a farmer's market. And some stores have it, but it's really yummy.
Mm. How important is the farmer's market for you?
I'd say actually really important, and mostly because it's fantastic exposure, but we've had made a lot of contacts through there. You know, people come, they do come looking for products, bigger companies. One of the Progressive or whatever sales reps, and he approached me and said, how many numbers? What are your units? And it would be in the millions. We just can't do that. You know, that's why we need a factory. So, I'd say for making the connections, it's really important. And it's a nice little weekly income, keep the products moving, and people really learn about them.
What's the plan with the land? You have got some plans.
We do. We have... The farm is actually under new ownership, and we are talking about putting it into a sanctuary. Native New Zealand sanctuary. We don't know when, but yeah, that's coming down the pipeline.
Is there anything more you can tell us at this point?
I'll reserve it for when we're putting up our predator-proof fence.
And what about the Fijian orchard? What will
that
happen?
That will stay, and ideally we'd get... I'll be busy, but ideally we'd still be selling the Fijo is to the various juice companies and other companies that we sell to, and hopefully that individual will create a factory where we can continue doing the wedges and the puree and the powder. And then when the kakas return and the other native birds, they'll have Fijos to eat.
To feast on.
Yeah.
Heather Smith of Heather's Fijoas near Havelock North in Hawke's Bay. Go to our webpage, rnz.co.nz/countrylife, for photos of the beautiful setting, and there's also a video there too of the harvest.
Hello, my name's Aaron Simpson. I'm a horticultural tutor and organic grower in the Hawke's Bay, and you're listening to Country Life.
The Akaroa Salmon Farm floats in the ocean on the southern side of Akaroa Harbour on Banks Peninsula. Duncan Bates, who built the farm with his father Tom, is heading out to check on the fish with Rick Smale, the salmon farm's manager. Cosmo met them on the wharf at Wainui before they climbed aboard one of the farm's boats. First up, he talked to Duncan.
We based ourselves in Wainui because it's a little bit closer to the production farms. It's also where my family settled back in the 1850s. My great-great-grandfather farmed in Wainui Valley. So, you know, there's a little bit of a legacy behind that as well. So we established the salmon farm in the 70s and 80s, you know, when farming was going through those massive changes. You know, we were looking for diversification and this opportunity presented itself. So we took it. Dad worked on the compliance side of putting the farm in the harbour, so back then it was the Akaroa County Council, and there might have been 10 councillors, and we all, you know, we knew them. Dad knew them better than me because I was younger.
Because I guess you would have needed a licence to be able to set up the farm.
Yeah, they gave us leave for 1 year because nobody really knew what we were going to do, including us. And so they said, yeah, go out there and do this for a year and we'll see what it looks like after a year. And so we did that and they came out and we were still there. There was a lot of no-sayers that believed, you know, our infrastructure would get washed up on the beach. But it didn't and we were still there, and the councils then said, OK, just keep going for another year. We quite like what we're seeing. And after 2 years, they allowed us then to go to the Ministry of Fisheries and apply for a marine farming licence.
So this hadn't been done prior to that in the harbour?
No, not in Akaroa. There was some farms
just starting up in the Marlborough Sounds, and there was also some operations, Big Glory Bay down in Stewart Island.
Yes. Mm. So were you and your father learning along the way?
Yeah, for sure. This is 1984 we're talking. I'd just left Lincoln University, and I got a job at the Tent Burn Hatchery that was operated then by the New Zealand Salmon Farming Company. And I worked there for 3 or 4 months, and then I went down to their production farms down in Stewart Island, and I worked down there for a year. So that was my training in salmon farming, and what little knowledge that I accumulated, we brought up here and put the farm into place and put our first fish to sea in December of 1986.
Did you build the original pens yourself?
Yeah, we did. It was always from the get-go, it was a very hands-on type of operation. We didn't have a lot of capital to start the business. I was lucky enough to get a loan from the Rural Bank. So we had to learn how to do most things ourselves. So mostly I did the salmon farming, feeding fish. I used to drive out to Land's End and then walk down the hill. I had a little wooden dinghy that I used to row out to the farm on, and there was a vessel that operated out of Akaroa. He used to bring out our feed for me. They were in 25 kilogram bags back then. And that was the start of salmon farming.
And now I think you told me you've got, what, 70 employees in total?
In total, yeah. So, you know, 13 guys out here. They, you know, not always 13 working at any one time, because they're rostered so that we can operate 7 days a week. And then the processing side of the business in Christchurch, there's quite a few people employed there, and then there's an administrative staff as well. So, you know, in total there's around about 70 people.
Mm. Wow, what a success story.
Yeah, we're dead lucky, you know. It's a pretty good product and people like to eat it. And, you know, it was a sort of a vision that Dad and I had, that, you know, we could become a vertically integrated farming system as opposed to land-based farming systems where you sort of operate in a silo, so you're the producer, and then someone comes along and buys your product and it gets processed, and then someone else sells it. You know, we had this vision that we'd like to be in control of our own destiny, and that model's been good for us.
Mm. And of course, as you've mentioned, when you first started the salmon farm, land farming was going through quite a few challenges.
Very much so, yeah. Yeah, it was tough going. Mm. Subsidies were being removed. Not a bad thing in the long term, but at the time it hurt like hell, and we were looking for diversification, and the harbour allowed us to do that.
Does your family still farm on the peninsula?
No more, no. No, just the salmon farm. The salmon farm has absolutely dominated my life for the last 30 years.
Mm. Rick, the operations manager, is at the end of the jetty and he's just got the boat ready because we are going to head out to your farm.
Great, yeah, let's do it.
Hi Rick, how's it going?
Yeah, good, thanks.
How long have you been working for Akaroa Salmon?
9 years now, yeah.
What does your work involve?
Just looking after the farm on a day-to-day basis and keeping the staff going, keeping them busy.
So would you spend a lot of time on the water?
Yeah, most days, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And so what's happening today?
We've got just net cleaning. We've got two guys out there working the ROV, and that's a seven-day-a-week operation. And then there's a couple of boys feeding as well.
Mm. What's the ROV?
It's a remote operated vehicle that cleans the net. They drive it from inside the wheelhouse, and it's a bit like mowing the lawns. You just drive it all over the net, and it cleans it. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, let's head out to the farm.
Good day for net cleaning today.
Yes. Yeah. It's good visibility.
He's in.
Rick's dog has just fallen into the water and he's swimming back to us. You quite like that dip, didn't you?
Shall we put the hammer down and get out there?
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
as we head towards the head of the harbour, and there's no sign of the salmon farm.
No sign yet. You need to get a bit closer before you can see it. The salmon farm's got a very low profile on the water, and that's the way we like it. You know, we don't like to be visually obtrusive.
That boat in front of you, that's our original boat. It's been at the bottom of the harbour a couple of times, but we lifted back up again. And
was that because there were storms? Or
the first time was it had been into an engineer to get repaired, and the engineer drilled a hole in the hull to get at something and then forgotten to cover the hole. So we put it in the water, and half an hour later it sunk.
Were you in the boat?
Yeah, a few people were in the boat, Dad included, and my uncle. It was made the news. Wasn't very pleasant, but you know, we've modified that boat over the years, and it's still a really functional boat for us, and we use it for feeding fish.
We have arrived at the salmon farm out towards the heads of the harbour, and the farm's sort of tucked into a bay, and the hills leading down to the water are quite steep, and there's a lot of native bush growing in the gullies. I guess this must be a big sheep farm.
Sheep and cattle, yeah. This farm here is owned by a gentleman called Roger Beattie. He farms Pitt Island sheep on this property. The farm further out towards the heads, that's Land's End, that's traditional sheep and cattle property owned by the Hutchison family through three or four probably generations.
Mm. Now, how many pens have you got here?
Oh, Rick's probably best to answer that question.
17 pens at the moment. Yeah, 17 plastic circles, and the boys are sorting some moorings over there at Lucas Bay. We've just put in a couple of 120-metre circles, so we're getting them all shored up.
What type of salmon do you farm here?
They're Chinook, or Quinnet, king salmon.
They're a Pacific salmon. Most of the salmon farmed around the world are Atlantic salmon. Their natural home is on the west coast of North America, from round about Sacramento right up to Alaska, and they were introduced to New Zealand back around about 1890 through to 1920. They continued to bring eggs from that part of the world to New Zealand to establish a sports fishery. Mm.
Do you have a salmon hatchery somewhere else?
Yeah, we do. We've got a hatchery. We're a quarter owner in that hatchery. That's just north of Christchurch, and then another hatchery that sits between Methven and Ashburton down in Mid-Canterbury.
And how often do you bring smolt here to the farm?
Twice a year we do a spring transfer. That's the bulk of our replacement stock come in the spring. We specify 30-gram fish to come then, and then we do an autumn transfer, and those fish, those smolt, are usually around about 100 grams. And we will start harvesting that fish in 16 months' time.
And, Rick, what sort of feed do the fish get?
It's fish-based, obviously, and plant-based meal and fish oil, plant oil.
And how much would you feed out a day?
We're feeding about between 5 and 6 ton at the moment.
A day?
A day, yeah.
Duncan, that must be one of your major expenses.
Yep, feed's right at the top of our operational costs. There's a sort of an overarching philosophy that I like to work with here in regards to our farming system. You know, I like to grow our salmon to replicate as much as we can, the wild salmon, within a farming system. And with feed, you know, way back in the day, we were a big user of fish meal. We used to go out, well, not us, but people used to go out and catch wild fish on purpose to turn into fish meal and fish oil, so that could be used to feed salmon and salmon farms. Through the years, you know, we've acknowledged that that's not a really sustainable thing to do. We were feeding 2 kilograms of one fish to grow 1 kilo of another fish. So our feed's been modified, and now we, as Rick said, we use plant-based proteins and algae. There's companies around the world growing algae, so that's where we source our oil from now, which provides our omega-3. into our fish. And we've become now a positive fish protein producer. So because we're using alternative proteins, renewable proteins, we can grow a kilo of fish now in a positive way. You know, I just love being able to do that.
Mm. I was going to say, I mean, some environmental groups have expressed concerns about salmon farming and the impacts they have on the ecosystem. Is that something that you are dealing with now?
Yep, we are totally on the front foot there. Not because we're trying to push back on polarised people in regards to the impact or the perceived negative impact we have on our environment, but being an intergenerational occupier of this environment, I'm absolutely motivated to maintain our environment, to farm in a sustainable way. And to that end, we introduced, probably about 10 years ago, a monitoring program, and that's made us be much more proactive in regards to biomasses that we're farming, our feeding systems, and it's just made us be much better farmers.
I guess, Rick, this is always a challenge for you, how to improve the operation.
Yeah, that's right, and yeah, it's pretty efficient with the use of cameras and making sure we're minimising the waste going to the seafloor.
Now, you've got some nets over all the pens. Are they to prevent the birds from swooping down and eating the feed?
Yeah, it is, yeah, exactly. Yeah, and as well as that, the smolt net we're just moving up on now, is that's to keep shags and things out, that any predators. And I mean, we do get the odd seal as well, and they would happily flop over the rail and get into the pen. So, yeah, it's a bit of everything.
How do you harvest the fish?
We push them up to that harvest platform over there in one of these rectangular cages and crowd them up and then suck them out with a big airlift pump, and they go over a table and we'll feed them through a stunner, pneumatic stunners, and then bleed them and put them straight onto ice there.
How long is it before they get to the processing plant in Christchurch?
About 3 hours, and then they get gill and gutted that afternoon.
Yeah. So how many tonnes of fish are you harvesting at the moment, a year?
We will harvest in 22 around about 700 tonne. Now, you know, that might sound a lot, but in salmon farming production terms, I reckon we'd just about be the smallest salmon farm in the world based in the ocean. 700 tonnes is nothing.
So do your products go mainly into the New Zealand market, or do you export a lot of salmon?
Pre-COVID, our market was about 80% New Zealand, all hospitality, food service, a little bit of retail, but not very much. And then COVID made us flip that around a little bit, so now we sell into retail, South Island retail, foodstuffs. That was a necessity because the food service market in New Zealand had just about evaporated. But the other thing that's happened is we've also had to grow the export market, and so now it's about 50-50. But I'm sure that from now and through to Christmas and onwards, the hospitality industry in New Zealand will continue to grow. And so, you know, hopefully we can get that balance back to sort of 70-30. It would be really good. That's where I'd like it to be.
When you were working alone on the original pen, did you ever think that your business could get this big?
Yep, absolutely. You know, I was 24, young, energetic, and my vision that I had is just about complete. I believe that, you know, we've got the ability to grow, you know, 1,000 tonne here on these sites and do it sustainably and do it really well, and we're just about there. And you know, I that pleases me a lot.
In terms of day-to-day salmon farming, what are the biggest challenges you face?
Probably weather. For me, it's a constant worry, I suppose. When you wake up in the middle of the night and there's a storm happening, you start thinking about the security of the farm. But the biggest one was about 7 years ago, and it was a big southeasterly storm, and it threw rocks all over the road up in Wainui there, and peeled the tin off the front of our feed shed above the wharf there. And I think they were, probably had 2 to 3 metre swells coming through the farm at that stage.
One storm pre-rick, the swell at Wainui was just too big that we couldn't get out to the boats on the moorings. So we drove up to Land's End and walked down the hill and put wetsuits on and swam out to the farm and spent the day basically tying up ropes and making sure that that the farm was was going to be there the next day. And we've been lucky always to have a really good crew of invested people here, and they're happy to, they invest themselves in the success and happy to, do that sort of work when required.
Have you had any unintentional releases happen here into the harbour?
Oh, well, I don't really like to talk about them. Yeah, there have been over the years. It's been a big learning curve for me, and we've had sharks get into pens and make a whole lot of holes. We had seven gill sharks in one pen at one time, and they made a mess of the bottom of the net, and we lost. Oh, that was around 5,000, 2.5 kilo fish. The local fishermen loved us for that. They're always asking me if you've had any escapes lately, and fortunately I can be saying to them at the moment, no, we haven't for quite a long time now.
How can you stop those sharks from breaking through the nets?
We've put shark guards on underneath the nets now, so we've got a second layer of mesh underneath, and fortunately the sharks aren't intelligent enough to know that they could push this first layer into the second layer and get their teeth into some fish. But it's been really effective.
How much water area does your entire farm cover?
So total together, the two sites, less than 5 hectares. So as a primary production system, we're utilising 5 hectares of surface space, and that employs 70 people. So it's a really, really good way of using a resource.
Now there's a feeding frenzy going on in the pen we're beside, because the man in the next door boat is blowing out all the feed.
And the other guy's looking at the monitor. The tools that they've got is a camera sitting at 5 metres depth there. So definitely if they see feed going past that camera, then they'll shut off the feeding. And what we try to achieve is around about a 90% satisfaction for the fish. If we can achieve that, then we know that we're not dropping feed onto the seafloor, and we know that we're not going to be feeding too much. But, I mean, this is one thing that I think is really important. So there are lots of feeding systems out there where you could remove the human side of feeding, but I want guys here looking at the fish, because that gives them and me a sense of how well the fish are. That's really important to me. You can't lose the fact that we're salmon farmers and you need to nurture your animals.
Recently, Duncan, you drafted a salmon welfare document. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so as an industry, we like to be on the front foot when it comes to this sort of thing, so we felt it was important that the industry was consistent in how we farm salmon and how we treat our animals. And then we got buy-in from the SPCA on that front, and they were very comfortable with the document we drafted. There's only one thing that we're at odds with, and they want us to introduce a camera recording of the actual harvest happening. Obviously, you can see logistically that's quite challenging for us to do that, but we'll figure out a way of doing it. And as an industry now, we think it's important that we're consistent and we document these things and stay on the front foot.
Duncan Bates there on a boat at the Akaroa Salmon Farm near Wainui in Akaroa Harbour. Cosmo was also talking to Akaroa Salmon's farm operations manager, Rick Smale. To see some lovely photos out at the salmon farm and from today's other stories, go to our webpage.
And you can subscribe to our podcast there too.
Do email us with your feedback or story ideas at country@rnz.co.nz or send a text to 2101. That's it for this week. Ka kite.
Have a great weekend. Spot you later.